and poverty. Black crime, he argued, reflected the greater crimes of the white society. Like Malcolm X, King characterized white racism as a series of crimes against black communities that created ghettos and violated laws designed to aid the poor, educate children, and promote black citizenship. Bold words of truth were necessary, King insisted, in order to deal with the great problems that we face in our society. Vietnam represented one such problem. The bombs that fall in Vietnam exploded at home, he observed, linking urban riots to the billions of dollars being diverted in the name of international war. He expressed his determination to continue to expose the relationship between race, war, violence, and democracy, even at the cost of a diminishing reputation in circles that once welcomed and praised him. King proclaimed that he refused to take a Gallup poll to determine majority opinion, preferring instead to be guided by moral conviction. Throughout his address, King discussed familiar themes in radically new and unsettling language. He deployed one of Malcolm's favorite words, hypocrisy, when discussing the gap between public concerns for black youth and the soaring rate of unemployment in this community, especially among the poor. He challenged the entire nation to support a jobs program on a bigger scale than the New Deal's Works Progress Administration, a program that had employed laborers, young people, writers, and artists from a wide segment of society. He called civil disobedience the militant middle ground between riots and apathy. Only a genuine act of massive concern could end urban rebellions, said King, once again highlighting his plans to leverage civil disobedience toward a radical domestic restructuring of society, one that had global implications because America could not fight and win wars against both poverty and Vietnam. Delivering the moral of his address, King challenged those in attendance to produce relevant academic studies examining the impact of civil rights as a social movement. I have not lost hope, he said. He spoke openly about his personal frustration and the difficulties he endured during these crisis days of political realignment, racial backlash, and riot politics. He placed himself in a pantheon of what he called maladjusted prophets, including Amos, Abraham Lincoln, and Thomas Jefferson, who sought new ways to create more just and free societies. King closed by assuming the role of the historian, discussing the relationship between slavery and the Founding Fathers, noting that blacks toiled in North America even before the Pilgrims and Jefferson arrived. King's allusion to the Pilgrims echoed Malcolm X's famous line, "We didn't land on Plymouth Rock, it landed on us." Like Malcolm, King now relished a discussion of the legacy of racial slavery. They made cotton king, he reminded the audience. They built the home of their masters in the midst of the most humiliating and oppressive conditions. King's lacerating words about white racism call for massive redistribution of wealth, an explanation of riots as rooted in anti-black political and social structures failed to grab major headlines, but the speech illustrated the ways in which major parts of his political thought paralleled Malcolm X's bold denunciation of racial oppression. The wide-ranging lecture, broken down in the Washington Post as psychologists hear Dr. King explain riots, did that and much more. King's speech laid the rhetorical groundwork and intellectual rationale for radical acts of massive civil disobedience in the hope of producing revolutionary change on an unprecedented scale. Near the end of October, King spoke about the riots to a sympathetic group of Washington officials investigating the roots behind 5 consecutive summers of civil disorder. King's secret testimony before the Kerner Commission came on Monday, October 23rd, the day after a massive anti-war demonstration at the Pentagon. The commission, ordered by Lyndon Johnson to investigate the root causes of the domestic political rebellions that had rocked his presidency, deployed field teams to urban neighborhoods, interviewed the unemployed and the educated, and conferred with esteemed political leaders in a methodical search to find a solution to the escalating racial violence. King testified that the origins of the urban crisis lay in the greater crimes of white society, which cultivated inhumane conditions in racially segregated ghettos across the nation. Unless federal power was used to address poverty in meaningful ways, King declared, Washington would cease to function. The Washington Post called King's plans to bring an army of the poor to the nation's capital an appeal to anarchy that smeared the Prince of Peace as a violent extremist. King and SCLC staff convened on November 26 in Frogmore, South Carolina, for a week-long retreat to plan the intricacies of the Poor People's Campaign. The campaign represented the culmination of a lifetime of activism for King, including his early critiques of capitalism as a young seminary student. Montgomery, Birmingham, and Selma had harnessed a quest for racial equality that would, in turn, further economic justice. A campaign to eradicate poverty would also galvanize King's anti-war criticism, which argued that the war on poverty remained stymied by war in Vietnam. King's August call for massive, nonviolent civil disobedience to end war and racial injustice now became further refined at the suggestion of Marion Wright Edelman and Bobby Kennedy under the banner of a movement to end poverty. King had spent his entire career making a case for the universal recognition of human rights through the particular experiences of black people. Now, he amplified those efforts by seeking to illustrate the ways in which poverty both transcended race, class, and culture, and could represent a common denominator for a movement powerful enough to end war, violence, and racism. At Frogmore, King presided over intense discussions about the probability of the campaign's success, the disillusionment that failure might bring, and the possibility of violence in Washington. Colleagues questioned the utility of protests at the Department of Labor and sit-ins at the Department of Agriculture. King pushed back against skepticism from some of his own advisors. In his deep baritone, he painted a portrait of a new kind of movement, one that featured the full panorama of American society, joining together for equal citizenship. King envisioned delegations of the poor lobbying Congress, while whites, blacks, Native Americans, and other groups walked and rode mules through some of the nation's most poverty-stricken areas toward the Capitol. He described these demonstrators as custodians of hope, whose sustained nonviolent organizing, sacrifice, and courage would move the nation, however fitfully, toward a brighter future. Over the course of the retreat, King reaffirmed his commitment to nonviolence through a program of radical civil disobedience explicitly designed to leverage the will of ordinary people against entrenched political institutions. In so doing, he tapped into the same impulse that had driven Malcolm X's efforts to internationalize the civil rights movement by leveraging the United Nations and Africa on behalf of black citizenship. After flying back to Atlanta, King formally announced plans to lead waves of the nation's poor and disinherited to the center of American power in the coming spring. King placed the coordination of the Poor People's Campaign in the capable hands of Bernard Lafayette, a veteran activist who had taken part in the founding of SNCC, joined the Freedom Rides, and served as a soothingly stable force among Nashville students during the early days of the movement. The celebration of King's 39th birthday on January 15, 1968, marked the convergence of grueling efforts to advocate for radical black citizenship at the local, regional, and national levels. King promoted a universal vision of justice through the particular and painful experience of the black poor from coast to coast. He increasingly faced harsh and unsubstantiated criticism that his organizing efforts would accelerate the epidemic of racial violence already sweeping the nation. The campaigns in Birmingham, Selma, and Chicago had sought to create a national movement through local organizing, but now King was targeting the nation's capital in what he characterized as a last-ditch effort to prevent America from drifting into further chaos by successfully leading a far-reaching movement to end racial injustice, poverty, and oppression. But while King huddled with advisors over the best way to consolidate anti-poverty, anti-war, and anti-racist organizing at the grassroots level, the FBI made plans to thwart his efforts. Codenamed POCAM, the Bureau's anti-King agenda grew out of its sprawling counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO, which targeted Black nationalists, civil rights leaders, Black Panthers, and an assortment of social justice groups deemed to be national security threats. FBI agents, working with at least one informant in the SCLC, planted false news stories and peddled unsubstantiated rumors, fomenting character assassination against King through a profile that circulated within the federal government. In February, he organized delicate negotiations with Carmichael over the Poor People's Campaign, gaining a detente from Black Power radicals skeptical of his anti-poverty movement. Carmichael met with King in Washington. Thoughts of their own mortality gripped both men. Carmichael's political risk-taking during his exhilarating 5-month tour of Africa, Asia, and Europe had lingered upon his return home. He engaged in secret talks to officially join the Black Panthers, a group rooted in the Alabama Black Belt that now took soaring flight as leather-jacketed armed revolutionaries for a new age. King arrived in the nation's capital, fresh from preaching the elegiac, the drum major instinct, at Ebenezer on February 4th. At once defiant and resigned, King publicly longed, in the event of his own death, to be remembered as a drum major for justice and a dogged warrior for peace in a land plagued by violence and addicted to war. Throughout the sermon, King had railed against the rampant materialism that gripped American society and burdened citizens with a compulsion to consume at the expense of the nation's most important moral priorities. He decried racism as a byproduct of the drum major instinct, the need to be first in everything at the expense of others, and to feel that their white skin ordained them to be first. King recounted talking to his white jailers in Birmingham about the evils of Jim Crow, only to find out that they were as poor as the local blacks protesting segregation. Instead of resting upon the satisfaction of your skin being white, King urged his prison guards to join the movement.
"You ought to be out here, marching with every one of us every time we have a march," declared King.
He then turned to the global implications of materialism and racism, which he characterized as a bitter, colossal contest for supremacy. Violence, in the form of militarism and the devastating consequences of war raging around the world, formed the third part of the drum major instinct.
"We have committed more war crimes almost than any nation in the world," King claimed, "and I'm going to continue to say it."
Like Malcolm X often did, King spoke of divine retribution for America's political sins.
"But God has a way of even putting nations in their place," he observed.
King concluded by optimistically contrasting the contemporary perversion of the drum major instinct with the life of Jesus, the exemplar who gave us a new norm of greatness. That greatness required the recognition that the greatest among you shall be your servant. King spent the next few weeks delivering public speeches, attending fundraisers, and recruiting allies for the anti-poverty crusade. Predominantly Black welfare rights activists turned the tables on King during an early February meeting, schooling him on the intricacies of federal welfare legislation before agreeing to send representatives to Washington. A more humble King met with nearly 80 Native American, Latino, and white organizers in Atlanta the next month in an effort to shore up support for the Poor People's Campaign. He longed to expose the racial and geographic breadth of economic injustice, as well as the awesome, unrealized potential of racially and economically oppressed peoples. In Los Angeles, after his Rainbow Summit, King spoke to the California Democratic Convention, but refrained from publicly endorsing any candidate. Bobby Kennedy, running as a late entry after Minnesota Senator Eugene McCarthy's surprisingly robust anti-war primary campaign against Johnson, left a message for King. Bobby pleaded with him to withhold any presidential endorsement until they had a chance to meet. Kennedy's own political evolution, from the Cold War liberal who sanctioned FBI wiretaps against King, to a hero of the New Left who spoke out against racism in South Africa and now ran for president as an anti-war candidate, proved to be a remarkable transition. Kennedy now sought a path to the presidency, based more on King's vision of a beloved community than on the Cold War liberalism that had propelled his brother's political ascent. King spent the weekend in Los Angeles recruiting community activists, grassroots organizations, and church leaders to the poverty campaign.
"Hot summers are caused by winters of delay," he told the convention.
King argued that racial violence remained rooted in collective inaction and neglect by government officials, political leaders, and ordinary citizens unwilling or unable to confront the depth of the nation's racial crisis. King spoke of the other America, where despair reigned in ghettos and wall-to-wall rats and roaches are more likely than wall-to-wall carpets. No wonder there existed a great deal of bitterness, despair, and anger among the people in the other America. He resolved to live in Washington as long as necessary.
"We are going to stay until we get a response from Congress," King vowed.
He continued his strident criticism of white racism, noting during his time in Los Angeles that
"there aren't enough white persons in our country who are willing to cherish democratic principles over privilege."
King's March 18th trip to Memphis, Tennessee, tied civil rights and labor activism in powerfully invigorating ways. The visit reunited him with James Lawson, one of his oldest movement friends and an advisor on the practical application of nonviolence to political organizing. 15,000 people turned out to hear King offer words of encouragement to black sanitation workers striking for a living wage.
"In a few days, you ought to get together and just have a general work stoppage in the city of Memphis," King announced to massive applause.
He presented the struggle for a living wage in the city as part of a larger national movement for social justice rooted in political self-determination, capable of recognizing
that if one black person suffers, if one black person is down, we are all down.
Buffeted by cheers, King delved deeper, tying economic justice to a fight for racial equality. By standing together, blacks in Memphis were reminding America that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages. He compared unemployment and poverty in the black community to the level of misery that whites last experienced during the Great Depression. King urged those gathered to recognize their struggles as part of a human rights movement. King distilled the high points of the freedom movement's last decade to this moment, declaring that
"now is the time to make real the promise of democracy,"
a sentiment he had expressed during the March on Washington nearly 5 years prior. He promised to return at the end of the week to lead a march through the city. From Memphis, King traveled to Mississippi on the first stop of a 5-day publicity tour for the Poor People's Campaign. It marked a return to the Magnolia State and parts of the Delta that he had last walked during the Meredith March. He traveled by small plane and automobile through some of the poorest counties and towns in the nation. King's appearance in Marks, a small rural hamlet in Quitman County, in northwest Mississippi, exposed the face of extreme poverty. In a ramshackle church that doubled as the town's anti-poverty center, King listened to black mothers recount the lack of food, clothes, shoes, and decent education for their children. 100 children attended the event, many of them barefoot and without proper clothes. Visibly moved, King wept as he listened to parents describe fruitless job searches and a brutal level of economic misery that simply overwhelmed him. Black residents of Marks offered personal stories of suffering, accounts of entire families without food or warm blankets. Andrew Young and Ralph Abernathy watched in quiet astonishment as tears rolled down King's face. King admitted to being deeply moved by what he witnessed and heard, then invited all who could come to Washington. At one point, a woman called out the president for having failed to deliver on his promises to aid the poor.
Johnson said when he came in he was going to wipe out poverty, ignorance, and disease, she said. Now where's our money?
King vowed to take them all to the nation's capital to find out. He characterized the deplorable living conditions plaguing the entire county as criminal and immoral.
God does not want you to live like you are living, he assured them.
King carried the pain of Marx with him through the rest of his tour, offering testimony of his experiences there from church pulpits and in interviews. He decided on the spot to originate the poverty caravan to Washington in Marx. King offered Marx, Mississippi, as an example of racial suffering that justified massive civil disobedience and would guide the Poor People's Campaign. The people of Marx reminded King of his calling as a faith leader, public intellectual, and international political mobilizer. In an interview in New York's Catskills Mountains, King recalled finding myself weeping before I knew it in Marx. The sight of dozens of barefoot, hungry children living with parents who are not even getting an income resonated deeply with him.
Some of them aren't on any kind of welfare, explained King, and I literally cried when I heard men and women saying that they were unable to get any food to feed their children.
King's efforts at galvanizing enthusiasm for the Poor People's Campaign bumped into waning staff energy and scant organizational resources. King grew increasingly depressed over the state of race relations, suffered chronic anxiety, and feared that a catastrophic reckoning would grip the nation absent a massive nonviolent movement capable of forcing a radical reimagining of American society. Friends, colleagues, and staff noticed the change in his demeanor. During his lowest moments of depression, he confided in Coretta and close friends that he dreamed of taking time off to recharge, write, and think about new liberation strategies. King still had standing offers to teach at Union Theological Seminary in New York, or to assume pastoral duties at prestigious churches nationally and around the world. But King had no real intention of giving up on the movement. Instead, he returned to Memphis 4 weeks after the Kerner Commission released its explosive report on urban unrest, which blamed escalating racial violence on structural inequality, unfettered white racism, and poverty. The report of the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders became an immediate bestseller, but its impact faded after the public had digested the depth of its political inquiry into the national soul. Over 600 pages of analysis detailing urban disorders in over 24 cities crested with the candid admission that white supremacy produced residentially segregated neighborhoods, schools, and communities whose impoverishment, hostile relationship with the justice system, and glaring lack of resources made them racially combustible. Looters, who had been blasted as lawless thugs by the president, pundits, and politicians, were revealed as Americans desperate for advancement. Rather than rejecting the American system, the report suggested, they were anxious to obtain a place in it. The Kerner report amplified King's call for massive federal expenditures to eliminate poverty, acknowledged Carmichael's observation about black people's lack of political and economic power, and provided sociological and historical keys to unlock the specter of black rage that Malcolm X died trying to harness. King led over 6,000 demonstrators through downtown Memphis on Thursday, March 28th, a fulsome display of black political self-determination that was disrupted by teenagers unwilling to remain nonviolent. Within an hour of King's arrival, sporadic looting, shattered windows, and arrests along the demonstration route were reported. One 16-year-old boy died, the victim of a close-range shotgun blast by police that was later ruled justified. The FBI, sensing King's vulnerability, pounced by disseminating news stories to friendly outlets and journalists that branded the nation's foremost peace activist a hypocrite who inspired violent civil unrest. Newspapers followed suit, interpreting the episode of violence in Memphis as a sign of things to come in Washington. On March 31st, Martin Luther King Jr. preached the Passion Sunday sermon at the National Cathedral in Washington. 3,000 people jammed inside the building, and another 1,000 listened through loudspeakers on the chapel steps. King arrived in Washington to shore up his support among white liberals, accepting Dean Francis Sayer Jr.'s invitation to speak to an overwhelmingly white crowd of Catholics who remained receptive to his increasingly radical social justice message. He spoke in the measured, calibrated voice that he often used with white audiences. The sermon's title, Remaining Awake Through a Great Revolution, drew inspiration from the Book of Revelation and explored what King characterized as a triple revolution unfolding around the globe. King challenged the nation to recognize how interwoven the world had become, a neighborhood, but not yet a brotherhood, he lamented. The unhappy truth that racism is a way of life for the vast majority of white Americans constituted the second great challenge the nation faced. King blamed a roll call of institutions, religious, political, and private, for failing to get rid of the disease of racism. He railed against the popular myth that time would lead to racial progress or that blacks alone could achieve full citizenship. King offered a political seminar, one of Malcolm X's specialties, rooted in the history of racial slavery and white privilege. He gave a capsule summary of the failure of Reconstruction to repair the political, physical, economic, and psychological wounds of a people who were kept in slavery 244 years. King contrasted the lost promise of Reconstruction with millions of acres of land in the West and Midwest given away to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. White privilege became tangible through land-grant colleges, low-interest loans to farmers, and a plethora of federally subsidized resources that remained unavailable to black Americans. In his opening section, King connected humanity's interrelationships and the ways in which racism impeded the development of brotherhood to a discussion of poverty. King recalled, once again, his recent heartbreaking visit to Marx. Trips to Harlem and Newark had also revealed new depths to the nation's poverty, where slumlords charged high rents while our expressways carry us away from the ghetto so the poor remain forgotten. He described to parishioners at National Cathedral the spirit imbued in the Poor People's Campaign.
"We are not coming to tear up Washington," he remarked,
refuting increasingly negative press accounts that had grown worse in the wake of Memphis.
"We are coming to ask America to be true to the huge promissory note that it signed years ago
in the form of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution." The recent White House Civil Rights Conference and President Johnson's own Kerner Commission, King noted, supported major initiatives to eradicate poverty and racism. He proudly held up his anti-war criticism and the condemnation that followed as an example of ethical leadership.
"I say to you that our goal is freedom," King reminded them. "And I believe we are going to get there, because however much she strays away from it, the goal of America is freedom."
At a press conference following his sermon, King told reporters that he would be willing to call off the planned April 22nd Poor People's Campaign if he received firm assurances that emergency anti-poverty legislation would be passed by the President and Congress.
"It would have to have a positive timetable attached to it," he observed, "and I don't see that forthcoming."
King offered an olive branch to Johnson, who now considered him a political adversary.
"I would be glad to talk to President Johnson or anyone else," he told reporters.
King also discussed plans to protest the Democratic National Convention in August if Congress failed to act.
"They will have a real awakening in Chicago," he warned, while noting that Republicans might face similar pickets at their convention in Miami.
That evening, almost as if in response to the panoramic vision that King had laid out at the National Cathedral, Lyndon Johnson announced that he would not seek another term as president, a decision that greatly weakened King's chances of procuring the massive political and economic concessions he hoped for. On Wednesday evening, April 3, 1968, having returned to the South, King delivered a speech in Memphis. He preached a message of defiant hope and resolute political radicalism at the Mason Temple to a crowd seeking physical shelter from a tornado and spiritual sustenance in the long struggle for black dignity. The local movement, where sanitation workers on strike proudly carried signs reading, "I am a man," reflected a cresting national wave, loudly proclaimed by black power proponents as the dawn of a revolution. Amid the tense crowd, King upheld nonviolence as a bulwark.
"The issue is injustice,"
he told more than 1,000 people.
"All we say to America is, be true to what you said on paper. The greatness of America is the right to protest for right."
King extolled Black Power's call for community control over economic resources in black neighborhoods by advocating for a boycott of several companies. He urged the audience to patronize local black banks, foundational institutions of the city of Memphis. He offered a forward-looking vision of a social and political revolution he might not live to see, while triumphantly recalling how Birmingham's struggles continued to shape the contemporary human rights revolution.
"We've got some difficult days ahead," King conceded,
speaking as much about the domestic and international political landscape as the local one in Memphis. He concluded his speech by bearing witness to his dual roles as a political and religious leader. He thanked God for allowing me to go up to the mountain, and then acknowledged further gratitude for having seen the Promised Land. King's admission that,
"I may not get there with you,"
would, retrospectively, lend this speech its prophetic power. King awoke on Thursday, April 4th, feeling rested after a good night's sleep. He stayed, along with Ralph Abernathy, in room 306 at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. Much work remained to be done ahead of the poverty campaign. In the short term, King dispatched aides to court to fight an injunction barring the SCLC from a planned downtown march in support of garbage workers on Monday, April 8th. Meanwhile, King lunched on fried catfish and convened strategy sessions with SCLC staff and local civil rights activists about how to organize nonviolent training classes over the weekend. He spent much of the day fielding business calls and making plans to bolster the movement in Memphis before returning his attention to the broader concerns of the Washington campaign. He shuttled between rooms 306 and 201, where SCLC staff gathered throughout the day for both sessions. His plans for the evening revolved around attending an early dinner with staff at the home of local minister, Reverend Billy Kiles, before preaching at a mass meeting later that evening. Andy Young came back from testifying at the court hearing, and King exhibited his playful side by engaging in a pillow fight with his lieutenant, whom he chided for failing to tell him of his whereabouts during the day. The tense mood of the previous week seemed to lift. King prepared himself for dinner by joking with Reverend Kyle about his expanding waistline. Just before 6 p.m., King made final preparations to decamp for dinner back in the room he shared with Abernathy. After shaving and splashing on some cologne, King ventured out on the balcony to check the temperature, which had cooled down to the mid-50s from an earlier high in the 70s. He surveyed the Lorraine Motel's parking lot and bantered from the second-story balcony with several of his aides awaiting his departure below. He teased Jesse Jackson for sporting a turtleneck and having no tie on for dinner. He asked Ben Branch, the leader of the SCLC musical band, to play Precious Lord for him later that night at the mass meeting.
"Sing it real pretty," requested King.
In an instant, a thunderclap interrupted the scene as a bullet hit King's face, severing his spinal cord and hurtling him toward the balcony floor. Emergency services arrived within 5 minutes of the shot. Police officers, part of a special surveillance unit to monitor the garbage strike, arrived on foot immediately. An ambulance rushed King to St. Joseph Hospital in downtown Memphis, where doctors announced his official time of death as 7:05 p.m. The death of the civil rights icon triggered a national crisis, sparking violent upheavals in dozens of cities. Police searched for an assassin, described as a white male by witnesses, and eventually apprehended James Earl Ray, an escaped convict whose guilty plea did little to end unproven speculation of government involvement in King's assassination. Rumors that Black Power militants would use King's death to launch an all-out race war ran wild, fueled by reckless speculation by law enforcement officials, incendiary words from political radicals such as Stokely Carmichael, and public anxiety. Carmichael warned the nation that a race war might erupt as a consequence of an assassination he blamed on America's collective racist consciousness.
"White America has declared war on Black people," observed Carmichael.
Large parts of urban communities seemed to agree with him. 125 American cities erupted into open political rebellion after King's assassination, turning the spring of 1968 into a national test of democratic resolve. The presence of 4,000 military and National Guard reservists outside the White House demonstrated the scope and reach of violence that King had spent his life decrying. Riots that broke out along Washington's U Street corridor paralleled the civil disorders in Chicago and provoked the imposition of curfews across the country. The Washington Post characterized King as a militant activist who burned with indignation against racial injustice. In Los Angeles, hundreds of young people marched along Van Nuys Boulevard carrying signs that read, "End White Racism," while 2,500 gathered inside of the Second Baptist Church on Griffith Avenue to listen to a tape recording of a King speech. 5,000 mostly white residents of the New York City suburbs traveled to the Bronx to sign up for an effort to clean up blighted neighborhoods in honor of King 2 days after his assassination. 70 Black soldiers were joined by 5 white Marines for a memorial service for King in Da Nang, Vietnam, where the chaplain called him America's voice for the wisdom of nonviolence. American flags flew at half-staff at Military Command, and China Beach, the recreational facility just outside the city, closed in honor of King's death. Bobby Kennedy heard the news in Indianapolis, the latest stop in his presidential campaign. Despite the news, Kennedy continued plans to address a rally in the city's Black neighborhood, where he came the closest he ever would to offering a public apology for his past mistreatment of King. In an extemporaneous speech, Kennedy reflected on the crisis of race and democracy in American society, an era of great polarization marked by racial hatred between Blacks and whites. Then he suggested an alternative American future, one that Martin Luther King Jr. exemplified. "To understand and to comprehend and to replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that has spread across our land, with an effort to understand with compassion and love." King's death ended one part of Kennedy's political career and ushered in his final chapter, one that lasted barely 2 months, as a political crusader whose disarmingly vulnerable speeches drew multiracial and multigenerational crowds right up until his assassination on June 5, 1968, in California. Too much political history and too many personal wounds prevented King and Kennedy from ever establishing a warm, intimate relationship. Yet, by the end of their lives, they had drawn closer to each other through a shared commitment to social justice. Black Americans mourn King privately and collectively. Major Black political and cultural figures, from Stokely Carmichael to James Baldwin, attended King's Atlanta funeral. Baldwin had last met King during an affair at Carnegie Hall in New York City, for which he had purchased a new dark suit, one that he wore weeks later, to his friend's funeral. King's death personally rocked Baldwin, who staggered toward the end of the decade weighed down by the murders of King, Malcolm X, and Medgar Evers. 4 years later, in Malcolm and Martin, published in Esquire, Baldwin wrote a beautiful elegiac essay that sought to reconcile the fates of two political icons he considered to be close friends. "By the time each met his death," Baldwin observed, "there was practically no difference between them." Baldwin characterized Malcolm X as a gentle soul who, even at his fiercest, possessed infinitely more humanity than the majority of his critics. What made him unfamiliar and dangerous was not his hatred of white people, but his love of blacks, his apprehension of the horror of the black condition and the reasons for it, and his determination so to work on their hearts and minds that they will be enabled to see their condition and change it for themselves. The world recognized Malcolm primarily as a honed political sword, cutting a wide swath through America's racial wilderness, whereas Baldwin remembered him as a master teacher who believed in black dignity even when most Negroes would not dare to. King's greatest act of self-creation, Baldwin contended, could be traced back to the demands he placed on a still-evolving country. He believed in the idea of America more than the nation did. Both men sealed their mutual fates through dual, posthumously converging, efforts at promoting radical black dignity and radical black citizenship as the keys to fulfilling America's democratic promise. 120 million Americans watched King's funeral broadcast over the three major television networks. Children stayed home from school, unions shuttered ports, and stores closed, as much to honor King's memory as to prevent outbreaks of potential violence. Lyndon Johnson's absence from King's April 9th funeral reflected the depth of personal hurt between the two. Johnson's White House, like Hoover's FBI, had recognized King's peaceful sword as a political threat, one ironically rendered more rather than less dangerous by nonviolent appeals still capable of attracting domestic allies and global sympathy. But Johnson circumspectly responded to King's death with acts of presidential kindness and dignity. Behind the scenes, the president assembled an emergency cabinet meeting the morning after the assassination that was attended by major civil rights leaders, including King's sometimes nemesis Roy Wilkins, who sat alongside Vice President Hubert Humphrey, Democratic and Republican congressional leaders, and Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. Johnson gave the room a modified version of his famous treatment, the president's signature use of his 6-foot, 4-inch frame to plead, cajole, and at times intimidate political foes and friends into submission. Johnson radiated mournful empathy to those gathered as he avowed that, despite the well-documented conflicts between himself and King, on the issue of human dignity, there was no difference between us. Johnson asked civil rights leaders to help heal a wounded nation, provided updates to them on the investigation into finding King's assassin, and promised to step up national anti-poverty and civil rights efforts. Johnson's televised address featured a president who had only recently announced his bombshell decision to not seek another term, calling for national resolve on the civil rights issues that King died for. The president designated Palm Sunday, April 7th, as a national day of mourning. In Washington, all government offices would remain unopened, flags lowered to half-mast, for the next 3 days, homage to a man who, just a few days earlier, much of the nation feared. Epilogue. The Legacy of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. I don't think that any black person can speak of Malcolm and Martin without wishing that they were here. James Baldwin. Perhaps no other person spent more time, respectively, with Malcolm and Martin than James Baldwin. In Malcolm and Martin, an incisive 1972 essay for Esquire, Baldwin offered a revelatory interpretation of the two deceased icons through his own personal relationship with each. Baldwin had heard the news of King's death as he was working feverishly on a screenplay for an ill-fated Malcolm X film. He remained fascinated by the complex human beings they both were, rather than the romantic clichés they were becoming. Malcolm and Martin, beginning at what seemed to be very different points, increasingly shared a revolutionary political vision that bound them together less as adversaries than as colleagues, whose initial conflict gave way to a shared destiny. Baldwin's intrepid analysis proved ahead of the times, since the legacies of the two men would be claimed in American and African-American political culture as contrasting examples of the pursuit of social justice, equality, and citizenship. Martin Luther King Jr. became an enduring global icon. 15 years after his assassination, the passage of a national holiday in his honor cemented him as a permanent facet of American political and popular culture. The holiday helped to turn King, one of the most eloquent critics of racism, economic injustice, and war the nation ever produced, into the most important symbol of racial progress in American history. Ironically, it was President Ronald Reagan, the smooth-talking conservative who publicly admitted to having disagreements with a civil rights leader, who signed his holiday into law on November 2, 1983. Surrounded by members of the Congressional Black Caucus and Coretta Scott King, Reagan signed national legislation in honor of a man whom, while living, Reagan considered the symbol of political radicalism. The day after King's assassination, then-Governor Reagan spoke to the Women's National Press Club, where he traced King's death back to our first acceptance of compromise with the laws of the land. He placed the blame for King's murder partially on the civil rights activists' insistence that immoral laws required people of conscience to disobey them. Reagan identified King's advocacy of insurgent protest as creating the atmosphere that led to his assassination, and imagined civil disobedience as the moral equivalent of those who practiced racial segregation in the first place. Reagan's signature on the holiday exemplified the contested national memory of the civil rights era, where a politician who opposed King's dream of radical democracy could be compelled to praise him while also co-opting parts of his legacy. The holiday did more than simply recognize King's individual accomplishments. It celebrated the civil rights movement's successful inclusion of racial justice and human rights as fundamental principles of American democracy. But Martin Luther King Jr. Day allowed America to bask in his dream, even as the nation stood further from fulfilling its mandate. King would not recognize himself in the uncomplicated, largely timid figure that much of the nation and the world celebrate today. The Radical King, who gathered an army of the poor to descend upon the nation's capital in defiance of critics, is airbrushed from history. The risk-taking King, who defied a sitting president to protest war, is missing from our popular memory. The Revolutionary King, who marched shoulder to shoulder with garbage workers, locked arms with Black Power militants, and lived in Chicago ghettos in an effort to stimulate social change, is forgotten. The King who proclaimed that America's greatness remained the right to protest for right has all but vanished, replaced by generic platitudes about freedom and justice. The national holiday magnified King's personal and political frailties. Biographers uncovered that he had plagiarized portions of his Boston University doctoral dissertation and used uncredited passages in speeches and other writings. The vast corpus of his published work, like that of presidents and other high-level political officials, was largely ghostwritten, a circumstance that ignited fierce debate in certain quarters regarding his intellectual and scholarly legacy. Personal revelations, aided by illegal FBI wiretaps of King's extensive and habitual extramarital affairs, stirred prurient interest and discussion over whether his illicit behavior tarnished the power of his legacy. The civil rights movement's heroic period, which spans the time from the Supreme Court's 1954 desegregation decision until King's assassination in 1968, transformed King into an unofficial founding father, burnishing his credentials as an architect of a new American republic, and turning him into a political titan whose moral power surpassed American presidents and global political leaders. Yet King's national recognition as a civil rights champion served to obscure his more radical ideas and activism. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a hard-won victory organized by veterans of the civil rights era alongside Black elected officials, became a crucial part of a new national consensus on racial equality in the post-civil rights era. In the shadow of continued racial inequality, the rise of mass incarceration, and the political realignment of the two major political parties, the holiday represented America's rhetorical acceptance of civil rights as a moral and political symbol. King now became embraced by conservatives and liberals as an enduringly unique example of American exceptionalism, but the elevation of King too often came at the expense of wrestling with his moral outrage at the nation's racism, violence, and inequality. Politicians from both major political parties crafted milquetoast versions of King suitable for mass consumption, easily digestible platitudes that ultimately ignored his political radicalism. What King characterized as the great wells of democracy became a metaphor for a panoramic movement for social justice that reshaped every corner of American society and inspired Presidents Kennedy and Johnson to make his cause their own. Yet the core of King's philosophy has become malleable enough to be embraced by subsequent presidents who opposed his political vision and radical policy agenda, rendering their rhetorical advocacy hollow. King's most important legacy is his conception of radical black citizenship as not simply the absence of racial oppression, but the beneficial good found in a living wage, decent housing, safe neighborhoods, health care, and racially integrated public schools and communities. The radical King waged struggles for economic justice in Chicago, spoke out against the Vietnam War, organized alongside welfare rights activists, and attempted to lead a poor people's movement whose multiracial makeup formed one strand of a global community that King characterized as the World House. Over the course of his tenure as a major civil rights leader, King grew increasingly bold as he confronted systemic challenges to his dream of multiracial democracy, what he called a beloved community. The proliferation of urban violence, rural poverty, institutional racism, and war forced him to reconsider his faith in political reform. Yet the radical King never abandoned his faith in America's capacity for social and political transformation. Near the end of his Riverside speech, he spoke of the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world he proudly engaged in. Malcolm X shared King's passion for racial justice, but not his patience with American democracy's imperfections. While King imagined blacks participating in a multicultural American dream, Malcolm witnessed a nightmare of racial segregation, police brutality, and misery that he distilled into a ferocious yet elegant stump speech that made him Harlem's hero and, over time, an icon of the Black Power movement. But after spending a dozen years in the Black freedom struggle, Malcolm was convinced that political coalitions, including the type that King extolled, might offer a shield of protection for a movement capable of guaranteeing radical black dignity and citizenship. Malcolm X's legacy proved more controversial and unwieldy, but no less magnetic than King's. Black activists to the left of the civil rights movement embraced Malcolm as the patron saint of black radicalism in the decades following his assassination. By the 1990s, Malcolm had re-entered the mainstream of American political culture through rap lyrics, music videos, the Spike Lee-directed film Malcolm X, and even a portrait on a U.S. postage stamp. His image remains an indelible figure of political defiance against racial injustice. Malcolm emerged as Black America's revolutionary truth-teller. A formerly incarcerated street hustler transformed into a working-class hero, capable of eviscerating the political, intellectual, and cultural totems of white supremacy. He's best remembered as Black America's prosecuting attorney who defiantly placed Jim Crow on trial and channeled the anger, rage, humor, and pain of African Americans living on the margins. Malcolm's most famous catchphrase, "By any means necessary," succinctly announced his willingness to defend Black life and lead a political revolution at any cost. Malcolm insisted that Black lives mattered and demanded that Blacks plumb the depths of their history in order to rediscover a racial identity that transcended slavery and segregation in an era where Black excellence and accomplishment were considered freakish aberrations. Hailed as an oracle of untapped Black ambition, progress, and political radicalism, Malcolm came to redefine the contours of African American political culture. His legacy endures in contemporary movements for systemic racial justice and human rights around the world. Martin Luther King Jr.'s promotion of nonviolence as a shield against Jim Crow's denial of black citizenship sharpened Malcolm's political sword, placing them in a conversation that would continue beyond death. As political antagonists, they verbally sparred over democracy's redemptive capacity. King's diplomatic temperament suited him for the role of Black America's defense attorney, a scholar preacher who defended Black humanity to whites with an unmatched depth of compassion and supple intelligence. He assumed the same role before Black folk, defending white capacity for individual and collective transformation as the hallmark of democratic progress, rooted in his profound faith in Christianity, the Black social gospel, and the Black church. At various points, Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X each utilized the political sword and shield. Together, they represent two at times overlapping and intersecting strains of revolutionary Black activism that continue to animate contemporary Black freedom struggles. Malcolm and Martin collectively grew to define the fight for Black dignity as part of an expansive human rights movement promoting racial equality, economic justice, and an end to war and violence globally. Malcolm's promotion of self-defense to protect Black lives against racial oppression both enlarged the ideological scope of the civil rights movement and obscured his larger political message. He argued that the crisis of race and democracy necessitated a dramatic, collective response to unspeakable political conditions. In contrast, King's commitment to nonviolence masked his philosophy's revolutionary potential and strategic advantages. In a world shadowed by racism, poverty, and violence, King's use of nonviolence seemed to many, especially Malcolm, weak or even cowardly. But many of his enemies and critics knew better, recognizing the aspects of coercive strength and power contained in each collective display of civil disobedience and every act of individual defiance that might lead to nonviolent revolt. King's revolution of values staked its national claim and international reputation on the moral high ground of changing hearts and minds. At the ground level, King, alongside thousands of grassroots activists and organizers, practiced hardball politics that leveraged mass demonstrations, protests, boycotts, sit-ins, and jail-ins to start to bring the walls of racial segregation and inequality tumbling down brick by painful brick. While never reconciling their disagreement on the issue of self-defense and violence, over time Malcolm and Martin came to share views on important issues. Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. found common ground and a measure of unacknowledged political convergence through their respective advocacy of Black dignity and Black citizenship. Their lone joint appearance at the U.S. Senate building illustrates their shared belief in the capacity for mass movements to transform democratic institutions. They both came to define America as an empire whose political economy seemed to thrive on racial violence, exploitation of the poor, and war. King's academic study and global travels armed him with an intellectual understanding of world affairs that grew more radical over time. Vietnam turned him into the nation's sharpest and most vocal critic of American imperialism. Like a man possessed, King raged against the triple evils of militarism, racism, and materialism in a style that shocked critics and might have made Malcolm proud. By the end of their lives, both Malcolm and Martin had sought to leverage international opinion, global political and intellectual networks, and the world stage in an increasingly convergent struggle for Black dignity and citizenship. Malcolm and Martin's enduring influence continues to shape America's contemporary racial and political landscape. Malcolm's ability to connect with Black folk mired in urban ghettos and struggling for survival grew out of his intimate knowledge of racial tragedy, economic injustice, and poverty. He came to understand his time as a hustler, thief, and prisoner as a search for political identity, religious understanding, and personal dignity in America's searing racial wilderness. Malcolm found his vocation as a political organizer, religious preacher, and public intellectual, but always remembered his time in the bowels of urban America, which included stints as a day laborer, Pullman car porter, and factory worker. Before the age of Black Lives Matter, Malcolm X promoted a global movement for Black power that recognized the transcendent dignity of the struggle for Black citizenship in America and beyond. By the end of their lives, Malcolm and Martin had added critical new dimensions to their political and intellectual repertoire. Malcolm X, the most electrifying political combatant for racial justice of his generation, found a state of grace through identification with human rights struggles capable of shielding black people from sprawling regimes of racial oppression that stretched from America to Africa and beyond. Martin Luther King Jr., the national conscience on race and democracy, took up the peaceful sword of nonviolence to aggressively call for an end to racism, militarism, and poverty. King, like Malcolm, charged America with political crimes from church pulpits across the nation, allegations that pushed him off the list of the nation's most admired citizens, ratcheted up FBI plots to destroy him, and ended his relationship with the president. The two men's stature had grown exponentially over the last half century. While Malcolm secured official status as a political folk hero through literary and cultural adoption by generations born after the Black Power era, King became enmeshed in the very discourse of American democracy, enshrined as one of the nation's founders through an annual federal holiday, a memorial in the nation's capital, and global commemorations of his legacy. However, their ubiquitous presence in American popular and political culture flattens a deeper understanding of their legacies. Framing them as simplistic dueling opposites obscures the ways in which each served as the alter ego of the other. By the end of his life, Malcolm viewed himself as working in tandem with King, even when he disagreed with the civil rights leaders' tactics. And Malcolm's swashbuckling internationalism, which included public criticism of the Vietnam War, offered a framework for King's radical peace efforts 3 years later. Malcolm and Martin publicly debated and privately wrestled over large questions about radical black dignity and citizenship. Malcolm's scalding critique of American democracy asked why blacks needed to protest for the citizenship rights constitutionally guaranteed after slavery. "Whenever a Negro fights for democracy," he reminded the world, "he's fighting for something he has not got, never had, and never will have." Where Malcolm identified democratic failure, King saw untapped potential. At the March on Washington, King urged the nation to make real the promise of democracy. He repeated this phrase in Memphis just before his death. Malcolm found tentative hope in the prospects for black political power through democratic institutions, but he hedged, offering words of fire, the ballot or the bullet, if black citizenship was not immediately achieved. King grew increasingly frustrated with the possibility of radical democratic reform, a pessimism that transformed him into a firebrand who publicly questioned the fealty of America's political leaders and citizens to the nation's founding principles. American strength, King argued, required the nation to actively embrace democratic ideals and not simply congratulate itself for having once expressed them. Martin and Malcolm loved black folks sincerely and unapologetically. Harlem celebrates Malcolm's memory well into the 21st century based on this love, which has been bequeathed to generations of blacks who remained enthralled by his broad smile, confident oratory, and wicked sense of humor. King's personal ease with the black poor impressed even his adversaries, who recognized the sincerity of his interaction with the elderly, unemployed, and children who flocked to his sermons, political speeches, and public appearances. Spending time with impoverished black folk in places like Mississippi, Chicago, and Alabama buoyed King, lifting his spirits as his presence captivated poor people who regarded him as a living prophet. Malcolm and Martin continue to offer the world powerful legacies of radical social and political transformation. Contemporary movements for social justice have helped to resurrect the historical Malcolm and Martin, challenging the pop culture icons that each has become. The roiling demonstrations against structural racism in the nation's criminal justice system in the 21st century have coupled the large-scale acts of civil disobedience personified by King's legacy with a defiant critique of the systemic nature of racial oppression that became Malcolm's calling card. These new movements both stand upon and expand on Malcolm and Martin's political legacies, offering an intersectional analysis of race, class, gender, sexuality, and the environment and their connections to black dignity and citizenship. Through demonstrations, protests, and policy agendas, social justice activists have forcefully argued that America's criminal justice system, persistently segregated and underfunded public schools, and discriminatory finance and housing practices represent a gateway to a sprawling system of racial inequality and economic injustice that has grown, not diminished, since the 1960s. There is no way to understand the history, struggle, and debate over race and democracy in contemporary America without understanding Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr.'s relationship to each other, to their own era, and, most crucially, to our time. The presidency of Barack Obama, in many ways, helped to frame the limits of a liberal democratic framework rejected by Malcolm X and vociferously criticized by the radical King. Obama's election offered a romantic, although unearned, conclusion to the civil rights and black power movements without having to examine the underside of the American dream that helped end the lives of Malcolm and Martin. The killings of Sandra Bland, Tamir Rice, Corinne Gaines, Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, Freddie Gray, and Michael Brown represent only the tip of contemporary racial injustice. America has innovated new forms of racial oppression in criminal justice, public schools, residential segregation, and poverty that scar much of the black community. What Michelle Alexander has dubbed the New Jim Crow, the continuation of a racial caste system through the justice system's disparate treatment of black prisoners, touches virtually every facet of black American life. Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. matter now more than ever. The deaths of Gray and Brown triggered urban rebellions in Maryland and Missouri, recalling the spasms of racial unrest that gripped the nation over 50 years ago. Malcolm and Martin argued that the future of American democracy depended on the wholesale recognition of black dignity and citizenship, struggles that are still ongoing and remain vitally connected to the social movements of the 1960s they helped to define. Malcolm promoted a bold struggle against white supremacy as the corollary to a passionate crusade for black dignity. He did more than hurl general accusations. He prosecuted his case through historical methodology that meticulously recounted the litany of crimes perpetrated against black people. Malcolm's rhetorical sword evolved from brandishing punishing truths about racial injustice into inspiring community pride by offering unmerited grace to all who identified themselves as human rights activists. Martin Luther King Jr. marshaled his love for black lives through a strategic rebellion that left room for compromise. King's hopes for racial rapprochement with both the architects and beneficiaries of racial oppression faltered in the face of war, racism, and white supremacy. His defense of black humanity pivoted on a belief in mutual redemption for the descendants of both enslaved blacks and plantation owners, a faith overwhelmed by a harsh reality of state-sanctioned violence, poverty, and war. Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. sought a moral and political reckoning with America's long history of racial and economic injustice. Urban rebellion, entrenched poverty, and the tragic resiliency of Jim Crow forced King to confront uncomfortable truths about the depths of American racism. Having successfully climbed previously insurmountable political mountains, King set his sight on scaling the political equivalent of Mount Everest. Whereas Malcolm's philosophy of self-defense grew to include forays into global diplomacy and recognition of the importance of formal voting rights, King's visions of peace acknowledged the need for a nonviolent political war that would be waged by ordinary citizens seeking universal truths through the particular struggles of the poor and racially oppressed. By the end of their lives, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. each drew closer to the political philosophies of the other, the sword and the shield no longer reflecting divergent worldviews, but dual, at times intersecting and even complementary strategies that continue to shape movements for racial justice, dignity, and citizenship in America and around the world. This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. Written by Peniel E. Joseph. Read by Zeno Robinson. Production supervised by Pavel Rivera. Produced by Dennis Kao. Directed by John Kovarik. Sound editing by Sean Bolter and Ian Lehman. Recorded at Literati Audio Studios. The Sword and the Shield is also available in print and digital formats from Basic Books, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2020 by Peniel E. Joseph. Audio production copyright 2020 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbguSA.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.